Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Casino City Gang for March 27th, 2014. I am Vin Narayanan, Editor-in-Chief of Casino City, coming to you from Washington, D.C. Joining me from Casino City's worldwide headquarters are Casino City's Senior Editor, Aaron Todd, Casino City's Associate Editor, Dan Podhizer. Greetings, gentlemen.
Good morning, Vin.
How are you guys doing today?
I'm really disappointed in you, Vin.
Why is that?
Well, you had a chance yesterday to go running into Congress to prevent the filing of online gambling prohibition bills, and I didn't see anything in the news about you rushing in to tear up the copies of the bills that Lindsey Graham and Jason Chaffetz submitted in Congress yesterday. So,
After Nolan Dalla was detained by the NSA, I decided not to take my chances with security.
Oh, Lord.
Especially seeing as I had lunch with him yesterday.
We don't need you added to the no-fly zone. We do need you up here next week. There's a no-fly list. The no-fly list, I mean.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, there is a... It would have been interesting, though. Could you imagine what the news reports would have been like if I tried something like that?
Well, I don't think that filing a bill is like someone handing a piece of paper to... I think you would have to, like, stop a staffer from hitting send on a computer, so...
Like, take your hand away from the send button. Take it away. It just wasn't going to work. Oh, my goodness. Plus, Aaron, you know, once you told me this wasn't going to happen, I stopped worrying about it. So, anyway, as you can tell,
it's not going to happen before. It's not going to happen before January 2015. I'll put it that way.
Well, geez. Talk about going out on a limb.
Well, I mean, after that, Aaron, you can't predict anything. But it won't happen in this congressional session.
Aaron walks way out on a limb to make that prediction. All right, so as you can tell, we're just in the game.
Anyway, we'll talk about this more later.
We'll talk about this. We're going to be talking about a pair of bills introduced in Congress to ban online gambling across the United States. We're also going to be talking about a new marketing arrangement between Caesars and the New York Rangers. And then we're going to wrap up the show with these new flip tournaments at Full Tilt Poker. What are they called?
Flip out.
Flip out tournaments. They have flip outs at Full Tilt. And then we will make our best bets for the week and give Aaron a chance to gloat about his excellent performance in the NCAA tournament brackets and commiserate that it wasn't a perfect bracket, so it really doesn't matter. But
excellent is a relative term. I'm being compared to you two chumps. So it's slightly above average, but it's not. I'm a rock star, but...
It's more proof that the people that win these bracket challenges know nothing about college basketball, and the people that do don't do well, because it's completely wrong.
I knew enough to have Dayton beat Syracuse, and that was actually an informed pick. That's the only one that I had that was informed. But the one thing I did know about, I got right.
Yeah.
It's the world's biggest coin flip.
It is. And that was informed more by your cynicism than by actual facts.
Well, no, it's informed by historical analysis.
Yeah. All right. Informed by historical cynicism. For those of you that don't know, Aaron is a Syracuse fan. He does love the Orange, even though he didn't go to school there.
Legitimate Division I NCAA basketball team within probably a 500-mile radius of my house where I grew up. So, I mean, honestly, like, I can't think of another, like, you know, Albany's there, and University of Vermont is there. So it's not like it's the only one that actually competes at a Division I level, but it's the only one that, you know, comes close to being competitive. So that's that. It's a very big regionally, you know, watched team from where I grew up, even though I was 2.5 hours away from it.
Now, did you ever go to a game in the Carrier Dome?
I've been to one. Unfortunately, that game occurred in my very, very early 20s, so I only remember about the first half. But I do remember that the Carrier Dome is not a great place to watch a basketball game. It depends on where your seats are. We had really cheap seats, and we were so far. We watched them play some terrible team that they blew out by like 40 points. Typical early season Syracuse basketball, and the seats were terrible. It was a fun experience, but we were in the stadium with like 20,000 people, and so far away from the action that you really couldn't. You couldn't see what was going on. But if you saw some of the shots of the Carrier Dome this year when they were on their, 22-23-0 run, they were filling up the football section. Like, you had a line of sight of the court, but I don't think you could see. Like, you could see that one team had possession and, like, where all the players were, but that was about it. Like, there's no way you could identify the players from where some of these people were sitting. I mean, they're sitting essentially at the 50-yard line. They put that court in one of the end zones.
Did either of you see the 30-for-30 Requiem for the Big East?
I didn't. I heard it was amazing. I would like to see it because I used to follow college basketball a lot more than I do now, and I watched the Big East a lot back in the Syracuse Georgetown rivalry days.
It was really, really good. Dan, did you see this?
No.
It was, it's outstanding. So for anyone listening, I highly recommend watching it. Even if you're not a college basketball fan or even a college sports fan, you really should see it because it's a remarkable documentary about a very specific time in history. And it shows the rise and fall, both culturally and economically, of a major force in American society, in American sports, which is the Big East. And it's really remarkable. But one of the things they talk about, Aaron, is the Carrier Dome, how that opened up in like 1980 or 1981, like the second year of the Big East or something like that. The Carrier Dome opening up, and Dave Gavitt, who created the Big East, it was by dint of his force and his personality the Big East was created, him looking at the Carrier Dome and realizing, you want to know what, that's the future of the Big East. And with that, he pushed all of these universities to get out of their small local gyms and get into NBA arenas. I mean, they couldn't necessarily get a Carrier Dome-sized place to play, but they could get into NBA arenas because they were all either near or close to NBA teams. And so that's how a lot of them ended up in NBA arenas. They were pushed to do that by the Big East. And while that worked and that helped propel the popularity of the league and the TV ratings and all that sort of stuff, ultimately it backfired on them because now you have these really good basketball programs who don't have their own gyms and don't have the ability to fill up the NBA arenas if they're not playing well, and you get really dead home courts. And it's just a different atmosphere for those schools. So it was really good for that specific period of time, and it helped propel the growth in the league, but ultimately it came back and backfired on them a little bit. And the 30-for-30 doesn't deal with how it backfired on them a little bit. It was sort of too much for the scope of just an hour, but it was really smart. Anyway. And yeah, Dan, all this stuff happened before you were born, so
Oh, yeah.
You probably...
It's like written in the Old Testament.
Yeah, I mean, Jordan hitting a baseline jumper and Dean Smith being the only person that could hold Michael Jordan under 20 points probably doesn't mean anything to you. So let's start with... And we'll start with the World Series of Poker, and then we'll jump into looks like going to be a semi-contentious topic about these bills in Congress. But let's start with the World Series of Poker. WSOP.com sees it interactive. Proved that they can copycat with the best of them when they signed a deal with the New York Rangers, and I guess a partial deal with the Knicks as well, but mostly with the Rangers. A marketing deal that's going to give them presence at Madison Square Garden during the Rangers' home games, including branding on the scoreboard, ribbon boards, marketing opportunities, website advertising. This follows on the heel of a similar arrangement that B1 Party set up with the New Jersey Devils and the Philadelphia 76ers. So this copycat arrangement, guys, let us note that New York City is the major media market in the New Jersey area. New Jersey doesn't have its own media market. The New Jersey media market is split between two areas. It's split between Philadelphia and New York City. Given that media context, what did you guys think of this deal between the Rangers and WSOP.com? Was this just a copycat move, or does this have the potential to really help the WSOP.com?
Well, my initial reaction to this was more of a confusion of, you know, if the Rangers are indeed capturing a lot of this North Jersey market, which, you know, from what I've heard that they are, there's a lot of Rangers fans in North Jersey, then where are the Devils fans coming from? And where are they getting, you know, how is the party poker relationship working for them in terms of attracting people in New Jersey? I mean, I guess it makes sense for the Rangers and the WSOP to partner, but how many hockey fans could there be if you already have a significant portion of North Jersey fans rooting for the Rangers? That was the only thing the big thing that stood out for me.
All right, so I guess we need to delve into the nature of NHL fandom here.
NHL expert. I will defer to him.
And I will make a valiant. I spent several years covering the league, so I will make a valiant effort to explain the nature of NHL fandom in New Jersey and New York. So, in the New Jersey area, you have three types of fans, of which there are crossover. You have diehard New Jersey Devil fans, diehard, and you have a core that does well. And I think these are the fans that came out and rooted for them when they were playing at Brendan Byrne Arena in the Meadowlands, and they're still rooting for them when they play in Newark at the Prudential Center. So you have that core of diehard fans. They absolutely love it. And then you have two distinct groups of casual fans. You have casual Devils fans who are also Ranger fans. And you have casual Devils fans who are also Flyers fans. And they will go to Newark for a game because, A, the tickets are cheap, B, the Devils are doing well, and C, there are some good bars around Prudential, the Prudential Arena. And it's a good social time out there. And so the crowds at the Prudential Center for the New Jersey Devils are comprised of those three fan groups. Now, the core New Jersey Devil fans, the diehard fans, is significantly smaller than the core diehard Philadelphia fan and significantly smaller than the core diehard Rangers fan. When you couple that with the fact that New Jersey's had significantly more playoff success over the course of the past 15 years than the Rangers or the Flyers, you end up with a fairly stable fan base. Is the fan base for New York a lot more? Yes. Even within New Jersey, there are more Rangers fans than there are Devils fans. And even within Philadelphia, there are probably more even in South Jersey, there are more Flyers fans than there are Devils fans. And then the Devils also appeal to that particular group of people who have New Jersey State pride. These are the people that get really mad that when you host a Super Bowl in Giant Stadium, or I guess it's MetLife Stadium now, that they call it a New York Super Bowl and not a New Jersey Super Bowl.
Right. So again,
yes.
Again, it seems like And this isn't a criticism of the WSOP deal with the Rangers. It just seems like there can't possibly be enough Devils fans to make the party poker deal worth it. I don't know.
There probably are. Because the one thing you know about Devils fans for sure is they live in New Jersey. You don't have people in Manhattan crossing the river to go to games. So look at it as more targeted marketing rather than volume marketing.
Okay. Well, with that said, I think the WSOP deal is still very good. And I think it's interesting that these sites are, you know, ostensibly marketing for teams that don't play in legal jurisdictions, but they are targeting people who do play in legal jurisdictions, and they're building brands for what it seems like for the future.
Yeah, I mean, Aaron, to me, the thing that strikes me here is the key is getting on TV in front of New Jersey
customers. Yeah, absolutely.
The only way to do that is in New York or Philadelphia.
Absolutely. You get in a New York marketplace, you get on TV in New York, and that's going to be huge. The other thing I think that's notable about this deal is if you look at the two teams in general, you look at the Devils and you look at the Rangers have a much bigger fan base, not only in the greater New York, New Jersey metropolitan area, but nationally. I mean, the Rangers are really kind of a national hockey brand, even though they haven't been great in quite some time.
Have you been? Have you swallowed ESPN marketing hook, line, and sinker?
Well, what do you mean? It's just a New York team. They're a New York team, and they're a national team because there are a lot of people who grow up in New York and move to other places and still root for that team. I don't think that, you know, there are people in L.A. rooting for the Rangers. I don't think there are people there are a lot of people in Florida rooting for the Rangers, probably, because they're all old and they grew up in New York.
The Red Wings are more of a national team than the Rangers.
But there's no.
I mean, you go to any Red Wings game. You got 12, 15, you got 10,000 Red Wings fans at the stadium at any arena where they're playing.
I get it, Mr. Detroit. I'm not saying you're wrong, but I'm saying that from the perspective of the World Series of Poker, which is trying to build a more of a national brand than right now than Party Poker is, because they're in two. WSOP.com is in two states. They're going to be in any state they can. I'm sure they're going to get into every state that they possibly can. I think that this deal makes more sense than the Devils deal. I don't think you find a whole bunch of Devils fans outside of New Jersey. I think you find a lot more Rangers fans outside of New York, New Jersey.
Yeah, well, that's true. My objection to the Rangers being a national team is every time the Rangers do something, ESPN breaks in with breaking news because Linda Cohn is a Rangers fan. And it's just annoying, even though, you know, it's some minor deal.
Well, all right, let's also put this in perspective here. The Rangers might be one of the biggest markets in the NHL, but the NHL is the eighth most popular sport in America. So,
yeah,
you know, this isn't like the Yankees or anything like that.
No, but I think part of why they've gone with targeted hockey is, one, hockey has some experience taking online gaming money with Toronto and Vancouver having done so in the past. And two, or more importantly, just from a demographic standpoint, there's a good crossover between the demographics of hockey fans, particularly those in the arena, and online poker players. It skews young male.
Sure. Well, I think all sports tend to do that, too.
Yeah, hockey does more. I mean, yeah,
baseball skews old male. It does. I mean, like, you look at surveys and, like, the average viewership for the World Series was, you know, white men in their 50s. That's not an online poker demographic. I mean, are there white men in their 50s who play online poker? Sure. Yeah. I mean, but it's not, and there certainly are white men in their 50s who do play online poker. But that's, you know, you're looking for men 30 and under is what you want for your demographic, and that doesn't work in baseball.
Yeah, it's actually similar in fantasy baseball, too. I mean, one of the things at iGaming North America, which I was attending last week, that they noted in fantasy baseball was your sweet spot for fantasy baseball customers, the season-long variety, not the daily variety, but the seasonal and the traditional fantasy baseball, is mid-40s and older. That's their customer, and that's why fantasy football surpassed fantasy baseball when fantasy baseball for years was king, is because fantasy baseball never really caught on, the season-long variety with the younger demographic. Not the way
well,
fantasy
it's just
football
not instant
did.
Enough. I mean, it takes a long time to develop. You know, in fantasy football, you get your results on a Sunday. You know, you get to watch all the games, and you get to watch it as it happens. Baseball, you can't watch every night. You can't watch all the games every night. You can't, you know, see your players. Unless you get the MLB package, you've got access to one, maybe two, maybe three, depending on the market where you live, games that you can watch. And you know, if you've only got one player, if you got a pitcher that's not pitching, you know, why are you going to watch the game just to see what may have an impact on your fantasy game? You know, I've done fantasy baseball before, and it was fun, but it's not something that I would ever do again. Fantasy football, I haven't done in a few years, but I could see myself getting back into it because it does make the games. It makes Sunday a lot of fun to kind of watch the games and you know see as things are going. And you get the NFL does an amazing, you know, the networks do an amazing job pumping out the updated statistics, you know, on your screen for every game on the ticker on the bottom. They, you know, they give you all the key numbers on who's got receptions and touchdowns and rushing yards and the passing, you know, stats of all the quarterbacks. So you can kind of watch that as you go and kind of get updates as you go. Or, you know, just keep it on, you just keep a computer screen open or a tablet open or whatever, your iPad, and watch the scores update as they go. So it works well for football, but for baseball I think it's hard because it's night, it's every night, and it's just too long a time frame to work in work as well for the casual fan.
Yeah. Circling back to the online poker thing, these marketing deals with the local sports franchises in the New York, New Jersey area are actually critically important. And the reason is New York is the most expensive media market in the U.S. And these marketing deals where they're getting branding on the scoreboard and on billboards and on wherever they're getting it in the arena, these things show up on TV too. And this is actually one of the most cost-effective ways for these brands to reach out. I mean, as much money as it's costing them, it's still cheaper than buying a gazillion ads in the New York, New Jersey market. It's just less expensive. It's just New York and New Jersey and Philadelphia, it's just that expensive to reach New Jersey residents.
I think it builds legitimacy. You know, I think a lot of people were hesitant for a long time to deposit any money on an online gambling site because they weren't sure that it was kosher. They weren't sure that it was, you know what I mean? They weren't sure what I'm not talking about your hardcore online poker players. I'm talking about the casual player. You know, for a long time, so if they didn't make a deposit before, I think they were hesitant because they were like, you know, there was this murky gray area as to whether it was legal or not. A lot of people got comfortable with it because there was advertising on TV. And they said, well, if the TV stations are accepting advertising, then it must be okay. But that was always for, like, the .net versions of games as opposed to the .coms. You know, so that sounded a little shady maybe, depending on how closely you followed it. Now, if the team that you watch every, you know, two, three times a week, if the hockey team you watch two, three times a week has billboards in their stadium, and during the game they, you know, talk about, you know, go to WSOP.com and win tickets to a game, you know, where there's going to be a tournament where you can win tickets for a game. It's just going to cost $5. And they have like some sort of on-air promotional copy that the announcers read. That makes it legitimate. It makes it seem in people's minds, okay, this is legit. It's above board. I don't have to worry about whether I'm going to get, you know, my account's going to be closed and my money's taken away, whether someone's going to raid my bank account. It builds a legitimacy that's been lacking for quite some time.
Yeah, and the adjacency next to brands like Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun helped that as well. And Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun have been in the New York market for a long time. In fact, the Mid-Atlantic casino market is all in on New Jersey. The other interesting thing that it does is, you know, they're giving away tickets and access to the penalty box pregame. I mean, they're going to be able to do that on WSOP.com. And that actually goes a long way for hockey players. You tell hockey players they can get in the penalty box before the game, they're happy campers.
Yeah, and one thing they don't have to do is they don't have to really spend any time or effort educating the market because the unregulated market took care of that for them. So now they're just coming in, and all they have to do is continue to market themselves for legitimacy purposes, and yeah, I mean, the promotions are great for attracting the casual fans. The hardcore players who have been dying for it to come back, they don't need any of these promotions to do that. They're going to play anyway. So I think there's a lot of benefits to these kind of relationships.
Yeah, it's different. I mean, it certainly is. But I think overall it's a good thing. It's a good thing that the WSOP.com is involved in. It's a good thing that B1 Party actually helped pave the way for this. They probably made it easier for the WSOP to sign their deal with the Rangers, and that's good too. And let's see what happens. Let's see how this works out for them. But I do think it's for both brands actually, it's a cost effective way to get into to advertise in the New Jersey market. It's just so expensive there, and yeah, it does confer legitimacy, and it's going to reach some folks, so it's all good. All right, let's switch gears. To Congress, Washington, D.C., just a stone's throw away from where I sit now, and more than a stone's throw. It's about a quarter mile from where I sit now. In the Capitol in Congress, a pair of bills, gentlemen, were introduced to ban online gambling over the Internet. Actually, Lindsey Graham hasn't introduced it yet. It's going to be introduced by him. He has introduced it. Never mind. He introduced it yesterday. So a pair of bills have been introduced. And basically, it's going to expand the Wire Act to prohibit all forms of Internet gambling. Bam. Period. Done. End of subject. This is what a lot of Republicans have wanted, and a lot of people against online gambling want, and what Sheldon Adelson wants. This is what they wanted ever since the Department of Justice in 2011 changed their position on the Wire Act and said the Wire Act doesn't only cover sports betting, and it doesn't cover other forms of betting. And if states want to offer intrastate betting, that is betting within the state's borders, they're well within their rights to do so. Aaron, you opened the show by saying that you will go out on that massive limb and say that this will not happen this year. If anything, it won't happen until 2015. Why did you hop out on that massive limb?
Well, Harry Reid is the Senate Majority Leader. Harry Reid's not going to let this happen. If it's changed to allow online poker and there's an exception for online poker, then it is conceivable that it could happen, but it still seems highly unlikely. I don't think that anything would pass without a carve-out for states that have already passed legislation and are up and running. Like, you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. You know, you can't tell New Jersey, oh, no, you're not allowed to do this anymore. I mean, yes, they could. I mean, there's no reason why they couldn't do that. I don't think that it will happen. The New Jersey representatives will all be up in arms about it, and I think representatives from states worried about their own their own states' rights issues will have a problem with it too. The thing that's interesting here is that I think has the potential to really splinter the Republican Party here, because you're going to have the social conservatives who think that this is the way it should be. But there's also a really healthy libertarian wing of the Republican Party who I can't see Rand Paul thinking that this is necessarily a great idea. I can't see a lot of the Tea Party members of Congress thinking that the federal government should be telling states what to do regarding gambling. So I find it hard to believe that a coalition can be formed that's gonna. I just don't think the votes are there for this to pass. Not at least as the Congress is currently constituted. I mean, that can obviously change in the fall, but I don't think the way that Congress is right now with the members that they have, I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah. So I from a theoretical standpoint, I get what you're saying, Aaron. One of the interesting thing to me is you talk about the Republican coalition splintering, and I don't quite buy it. Not because they shouldn't be philosophically opposed to it; they should. The Libertarian wing of the party should be philosophically against that. The reason why I don't think their philosophical opposition matters is these members of Congress fundamentally don't care about online poker and about online gaming. It's not on their radar. It's not an issue that they care about. And it's an easy issue for them to throw a bone to leadership and say, see, we voted with you on this. Because they don't care about the topic, they don't care about the issue, and it just doesn't mean anything to them. And so if they can go along with leadership on this, and leadership is for this, then they're good to go. Look, Reed has long been uncomfortable with online casinos. He's very comfortable with online poker. He's not comfortable with online casinos. This gives him a perfect out to negotiate an online poker-only federal legislation. And so if you're going to see anything happen this year, it would be online poker only federal legislation, because this gives Reed a perfect vehicle and a perfect region to negotiate. And he's been on Dean Heller to bring some Republicans along. And Dean Heller can go to the Republicans and say, hey, Lindsey Graham did this. Let's not go as far as he did, but let's go online poker only. It's a good compromise. It'll satisfy what Lindsey wants. It'll, to a certain degree, satisfy what Sheldon wants, but it's a bill that can get through, and it's a good compromise material. And so I actually think this makes federal online poker legislation, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but a lot more likely to happen this year than it has been in the past. The only question, and this becomes a matter of political calculus, is do Sheldon Adelson and his crew look at the electoral landscape and they say, you want to know what? We're going to win the Senate next year. Let's go ahead and wait till we win the Senate. I mean, we're going to win the Senate in the elections this year. Let's go ahead, wait till 2015. Pass our bill the way we want it and see what happens. So
yeah,
that's
that
the real political
the executive
calculus
office,
that's
though?
Happening right now.
Does that get through
sure, why not?
The executive office?
Yeah, look, the bottom line is no one knows what Barack Obama thinks of online gambling, and he probably doesn't think anything of it. In addition to that, you have – I mean, we talk about the Republican Party splintering. The Democratic Party is going to splinter over this issue as well. Dianne Feinstein is going to sign on with this bill if she hasn't already. She doesn't
here's
like online
thing,
gambling.
Okay, yeah, but here's the thing. Let's say you're right, and this gets all the way to the presidency, whether it's Obama or whether it's whoever the president is in 2016. You're going to have a guy like Chris Christie, who is a Republican, and he's going to be one of the most outspoken voices against this, and Obama's going to be looking at that and be like, okay, well, what's going on here? Because this is not aligned with what your party wants. And I think once it gets to him, he's going to take a real hard look at it, and I don't think that it will pass the presidency.
I'm not necessarily buying that. You get 10, 12 top senators like Dianne Feinstein, and those votes are out there to be had. You get them on board with something like this, Obama sees, hey, yeah, they're on board, this crosses party lines, boom, signature, pen to paper.
It'll be coming at the end of his presidency, and there's just no incentive for him to do that.
His incentive is to help his people in Congress. I mean, just to help the party members. If Democrats have said, yeah, we're signing on with this bill, and Obama doesn't really care one way or the other about the bill, and there's nothing that indicates that Obama really cares about this topic or this subject,
then yeah, I mean, the assumption has always been, just from a political calculus standpoint, that whatever gets to the executive office is going to be signed through. If it's attached to a must-pass bill, it'll get signed through because it's attached to a must-pass bill. And if it gets there as a standalone bill, it'll get there and it'll be signed. And the reason it'll be signed is because Obama doesn't care. Now, that political calculus hasn't been tested. And we really don't know where Obama stands on this, so it's hard to say. But if enough Democrats get behind the bill in either direction, Obama has plenty of reason to get behind something like this and sign it. And we realistically don't know where Chris Christie's going to be in the primary mix, in the Republican primary mix in 2016. I mean, we don't. We don't know if this whole bridge thing has sunk his candidacy, or we don't know if he's going to be a primary voice or he's going to pull out and his voice is going to be non-existent. We have no idea.
Well, I don't know if his position necessarily matters. I mean, if he's president, obviously it's not, you know, he's not going to let this pass, but he's still going to be voicing an opposition to it, and he's a very strong voice. I mean, you know, he has the
ability, I think, to convince people who don't care about this issue to come to his side on it. Like, I think people who are passionate about it one way or the other are going to, you know, think this is the way we should do things. I don't think he's going to convince people to be advocates necessarily for it, but I think he certainly can sway public opinion.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the interesting question is whether Christie would speak out in an online poker-only bill and whether he would seek to protect his state only or seek to protect the general philosophy that it shouldn't be online poker only. And my instincts say he's going to speak to protect his state and not to protect the philosophy.
Well, I think it'll depend on what the landscape looks like at that point. I think he'd be open to compromise, but certainly not at the beginning.
Yeah, but once again, to come down to Christie's motivations, is Christie's motivation to protect the way it is in New Jersey right now and therefore carve out an exception in New Jersey, or is Christie's motivation to protect the right to gamble online for everyone? And I would expect him to protect New Jersey residents' rights and not the rights for everyone.
Well, again, it depends where he is in his own personal situation. It's not about what he personally believes. It's about what he thinks is going to help him best politically. And if he's the governor of New Jersey, then he's going to have New Jersey's best interests in mind. And if he's running for president, he's probably going to take a more compromising approach.
Well, yeah, but in either way, his voice doesn't really help, is what I'm trying to say. I mean, it helps and it doesn't help. If his voice helps in the sense that it carves out something for New Jersey, good for New Jersey. But it doesn't help the rest of the country. And if he's in the middle of a...
I don't ever see this getting to a point where a federal ban is implemented but a grandfather clause exists. I just don't see that happening.
That's what they did with sports betting.
Yeah, but nobody likes that.
Nevada likes that.
Yeah, that's true.
Nevada likes it a lot, and it didn't stop them from doing it.
But I guess the difference there is that Nevada likes it because everybody goes to Nevada to bet on sports. Nobody's going to go to New Jersey to play online poker.
That's not true. People already do. Not in waves, not in huge, huge waves, but people already do.
But it's never going to be a hub in the way that Nevada is. And I think New Jersey would, the online poker market would, or online gaming market would benefit more from more states joining an interstate compact than by monopolizing the market, because they're not really monopolizing anything. They're just, you know, serving their own customers.
Which is why I could see Christie being completely for federal online poker legislation as long as they left his online casinos alone. Because right now, he's getting more money from online casinos than he's getting from online poker.
So you're saying a federal online poker ban, but allowing his casinos to
No, no, a federal
no,
online
gambling,
casino banning.
Online casino. Right, online casino
go
ban.
Ahead.
It's an he means an online casino ban with a federal online poker only, except for states that have
okay.
already have so Delaware and New Jersey could continue to have online casinos essentially.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess he would be for that, but
I could see him completely getting behind it. I mean, that way, he satisfies the interests of his states. He protects the growing online casino revenue coming in. He protects the online poker revenue coming in with the potential of increasing it over time. Your online casino revenue is going to increase over time. And so he protects the interests of his states, but he shows the party and the donor class of the Republican Party that he's a team player. He says, yeah, I get the fact that you don't want it in the rest of the country, so we'll limit it to here. You get what you want. I get what I want, and we all win.
And the American public all loses.
That's the way this works. On that note, on that cheery note, I think we should wrap up our discussion. We should wrap up our discussion on the online poker bills. There, we'll keep an eye on it. We will track it as it wends its way through Congress and the various iterations of this, and we'll keep an eye on the movement of the bills. But let us turn our attention to something a lot more fun: poker flip-out tournaments. These are new tournaments that have been introduced at Full Tilt Poker. Dan, we will go to you to describe these tournaments.
So basically, they're online tournaments in which you buy in. Let's say you buy in for a $10 tournament, and there's 1,000 people who buy in. Well, you go to your first table of 10 players, and the very first hand of the tournament is an automatic all-in. Everybody from your table and from every table goes all in. It's a massive coin flip. Whoever wins the hand from your table then moves on to, it's like in a shootout form, just moves on to the rest of the tournament. So now 90% of the tournament field has been eliminated, 10% remains, and everybody who made it through the flip out is now in the money in the tournament, and you're basically playing an abbreviated version of a poker tournament in which everyone who survives is in the money, and now you're just playing to advance, which to me is awesome.
Aaron, you had the same reaction when you heard about this tournament. You said, that's awesome. What makes it awesome?
Well, what I think is really smart is I haven't played multi-table tournaments on an online poker site in a long time. And the reason is they're just so time consuming. A long time ago, I played in what was called the Ferguson on Full Tilt Poker. It was a $1 buy-in. I never had really more than $100 in any of my online poker accounts. So it was a $100 buy-in. It's a $1 buy-in, $10,000 guarantee. So in the end, there were about, 11,000 people who played in this tournament. $1 entry fee. I finished in 36, 38th place, something like that. And it took, I believe I started at about 8 o'clock. I finished at 3:30 in the morning, so almost 8 straight hours of online poker, and I won $20. Now, if I'd have won the thing, I would have won like $1,500, $2,000, which would have made the time worth it, especially for a dollar entry. But I won. I was up $19 after 8 hours for a dollar. Now, if you take that same tournament, you have 11,000 entries. Everybody goes all in the first for a dollar. Everybody goes all in the first hand, and if you advance, I mean, you've got a 10% chance of advancing. Obviously, you're in the money, and then you're down to, instead of 11,000 players, you have 1,100 in a tournament that was going to take 10 to 12 hours to complete. Is instead over in, 3, 4, 5, something like that. It's much more reasonable. I think it's really smart, and it's a great way to give recreational players a chance to play for those big prizes without requiring the time commitment that, you know, anyone who has kids can't do that. Like, I can't. My wife was away somewhere, which is the only reason I was playing in the tournament anyway, because normally we would spend the evening together, but she was on a work trip, and I had my son was home, and I thought maybe it would last until midnight. And, you know, if it lasted until midnight, I went to bed, I could get up the next morning at 6 o'clock, and I'd be a little tired, but it would be fine. Instead, I went to bed at 3:30. My son was up 3 hours later. I was a wreck, and I won $19. Not worth it. Not at all worth it. You just can't do that. I mean, and even if I didn't have kids, I still had to go to work the next day. So it's a great way to allow people to play low buy-in tournaments and play for, you know, in huge fields and take a shot to win a big prize while not requiring a huge buy-in.
Dan, you are approaching this from the non-kid spectrum side of the equation. What makes this awesome from your standpoint?
Well, I think the same logic sort of applies in that you can play a tournament in a much shorter amount of time. You can also play a lot more tournaments, or not necessarily play a lot more tournaments, but expose yourself to a lot more tournaments. I mean, the fact of the matter is, on average, you're going to win one of those flips 1 out of 10 times. So you could logically get the value of playing 10 tournaments by only playing one tournament, really. You're buying into 10, but you're just playing one. And so to me, that presents an interesting opportunity. The other thing about this is I think that it gives the advantage to more experienced players. And the one aside to that, and I'll put that out there right away, is experienced players typically benefit from exploiting the bubble, and that is right before the money happens, or the first few rounds before the money happens, the inexperienced players will tighten up because they want to make the money, and the experienced players will end up gaining a lot of chips that way. But, and even though that's gone, I feel like players, once they get to the money, which will happen immediately in these tournaments, will sort of play like they're free-rolling and play a lot more loose, and I think that more experienced players will be able to exploit that over the long run, and it's going to be better for players because they won't have to play through the long muck of playing online tournaments. It's just going to be, I think, honestly, I don't know why these sites didn't think of this sooner. It's just such a good idea.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about how this is going to be better for skilled players. To me, everything about poker is better for skilled players. It's because that's just the nature of poker. It doesn't tilt the balance of the equation to be dramatically in a skilled player's advantage. I mean, if anything, it gives... Well, let me finish my thought process here. It gives unskilled players a chance to reach the money, which is actually pretty cool. It's a chance that most of them wouldn't get. I mean, on average, if you took any of these casual players who really aren't that good and 1 out of 10 chances they have a chance to make the money, that's probably more of a chance that they have of making the money right now than they do right now.
Maybe. All right, I guess you're right in that saying that everybody's, the skilled players are always going to win out, and that's obviously true. I would say that these tournaments probably give everybody the same expected value over time as they would in before the flip-out tournaments and regular tournaments. But this allows you to increase your sample size, and so that allows you to increase your capability of making profit if you are one of the more skilled players. So it actually, while the edge percentage-wise is probably still the same, the volume increases, and that is presents more profitable opportunities for skilled players.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I mean, it's one of those things. Like, for example, this tournament is perfect for me because I lose interest after about 2 hours. And if I'm in the money after one hand, boom, perfect. And if I can increase, you know, where I am in terms of how much money I make over the course of the next 2 hours, even better. And so I think what ends up happening is that, or you get a player who gets lucky for 2 hours, lucky for the first 2 hours of the tournament. In a normal tournament, they might get lucky for the first 2 hours of the tournament, then over the course of the next four, they spew chips because their luck runs out. Well, if they're lucky in the first 2 hours of this tournament, the amount of money they're winning just goes up. I mean, you're giving more people, you're giving more people who have no business being in the money a chance to be in the money, which is why I understand what you're saying, Dan, but it's hard for me to completely buy it.
Here's what I think it does as well. You know, when you start a tournament, most tournaments, say it's a 15, say it's a whatever, $5, $10 tournament, whatever it is, you start with 1,500 chips, and the blinds are 5-10. So you start with 150 big blinds, right? By the time this tournament gets to the money, and that's everybody has the same chip stack, so everybody starts with 150 big blinds. By the time the tournament gets to the money, the average chip stack is maybe 20 to 30, if it maybe 50 big blinds at most. So, you know, obviously some people have a lot more than that, some people have a lot less, but the average chip stack is a lot lower than it was when you started. Now, I don't know exactly the format of these tournaments, but I'm assuming everyone starts with 150 chips or something similar. You win your single table all-in satellite, you go to 1,500 chips, and the blinds are 5-10. So you're starting much deeper. You're effectively in the money much deeper. So it gives people who believe they have a lot of skill the opportunity to play a deep stack tournament to move up the money ladder while they're still deep stacked, as opposed to being short. Now that it just changes the way the tournament runs, obviously, a great deal. If you take a 500 person tournament, if in order to, like, say you win precisely 10% of your flips to advance, whatever it is, in order to make up your buy-in, you need to get into the, you need to get 2% of the prize pool, in order to finish positive in the money. Considering 9 out of 10 times you're not going to make anything, the one time you do, you need to get in the top 2% of the prize pool. In a 500 person tournament, that means you need to get up to, you need to do better than ninth place. So say there's 500 people in the tournament, you're down to 50 immediately. In order to be profitable, you have to get to eighth or better out of 50. Against a random field of players, a person who thinks that they're a skilled player should feel like they should be able to do that. I don't know. I think it's brilliant. I think it's great for recreational players. I think it's great for especially great for low buy-in grinders that like to play deep stack. It's a fun innovation. The one thing, the only negative I can say about it is that people will be able to use this argument to say that poker is not a skill game. Look at this, they're running tournaments where basically you either finish in the money or you don't based on a coin flip. Now, I think you can counter that argument, but it's also a very easy argument to make. I don't think it's necessarily correct because, you know, you look at a 500-person tournament. Well, after the coin flip, one person's winning 0.3% of the prize, and one person's winning 25% of the prize. Obviously, 25% is a lot more than 0.3%. So the skill—that's where the skill comes into play. In order to get that bigger prize, you need to play well. But I can see how that argument could be lodged against this type of tournament.
So in order to get the bigger prize, and I'm back. Apologize for the technical difficulties. So you basically are saying, and I only caught the last bit of it, is in order to win the real money, and that's where the skill shows up.
Yeah. Like I said, you know, in order to be profitable in a 500-person tournament in this format, assuming you win precisely 10% of your flips, which is going to be pretty close if you play enough of them, you need to get 2% of the prize pool, which means you need to get 8th out of the 50 people that advance. If you do that every time, you're going to be profitable.
Here's the funny thing is, and I put myself in the quintessential casual player category. I don't know if I'm necessarily looking to be profitable. I'm just looking to cash in a tournament because cashing is fun.
Well, this is the easiest way to do it and the least time consuming. Well,
which is why I think it's pretty cool.
I don't know if most players don't take the "I want to be profitable" approach. Like, not every player is like, "Oh, I want to play a million tournaments, be profitable over the long run, and produce a 10% ROI." But they are going into the tournament thinking, "I want to make money."
Oh yes, look, any time I play, I want to be profitable and I want to win money. So it's not that I don't want to play. I mean, look, I play this game primarily for fun, and I'm guessing there is a class of players out there, casual players out there, that play this game for fun. And in the process of playing this game for fun, do we want to be profitable? Yes. Do we want to become better players? Yes. Do we want to beat people who are better than us? Yes. The answer is yes on all accounts, and we enjoy doing so. But we approach the game a little differently, is what I'm trying to say. I mean, we look at one of these flip-a-mint tournaments and or flip-out tournaments, I guess they're called, and we say, wow, that's a lot of fun. I can get into the money. Excuse me, I can get into the money without having to play a gazillion hours, as Dan and Aaron, you both have said. And to us, that's the real appeal for it. And not only can we do that, but if we actually concentrated for 2 or 3 hours, we might move up the money list. And that's actually a pretty good proposition for a lot of casual players. And, in fact, I think you'll find a lot of casual players playing a lot better in those tournaments than they would in a much longer slog, because in a much longer slog, they just believe they aren't going to get anywhere.
That's sort of a interesting take on that, in that if you're never going to be in a six-hour grind where you just give up and you don't care anymore, which is that's part of the battle of being a tournament grinder. Is you have to be able to be on the top of your game all the time, and you count on the less experienced players getting tired and making decisions based on other factors once they get 6 hours into a tournament. So, yeah, I can actually see that being giving an edge back to the less experienced players who don't know how to, who don't have that kind of experience.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think that's a big deal. I mean, and I think for a lot of casual players, that's a big deal. I mean, that's why when you look at pro sports, pace of play is such a big deal. And that's why people talk about it in baseball and football and basketball. You want the whole thing done in 3 hours. If I knew that this tournament was going to run 3 hours, and could for a flipping more, if I knew what that set period of time was and it was only going to run 3 hours, yeah, I'd be on my game for 3 hours. And I think a lot of casual players could manage that. It's once you get beyond that three-hour range that Aaron's talking about, the wife is out of the house or the kids are asleep or whatever. Once you get beyond that, you start to lose the casual players because they've got external circumstances forcing them. Either they're incapable of it, which is my case, or you've got commitments from wife and kids and that sort of thing. And so you've got to deal with that. I'm being told that I need to call back in as the host, so I'm going to do that, and I will let you guys wrap up this discussion and move into the best bet segment of the show.
Well, one thing that we were talking about, Dan, as Vint tries to reconnect here, is that you thought that the World Series of Poker should do this and have a $150 buy-in event, which is essentially if it would then run like a $1,500 buy-in event. I think that there's some logistical challenges to doing it, but I still think it would be pretty cool. What do you imagine the atmosphere would be like at the WSOP if you had a whole bunch of people essentially flipping to get an entry in a bracelet event?
Oh, it would be insane. You would get so many people who would be willing to do it. You could even make the flip into an event. You have celebrities come for the flip. Obviously, once the flip is over, it would just play out like a normal tournament. So logistics-wise there's nothing to worry about. It would just be the initial round of flipping that would be maybe tough to deal with. But could you imagine just thousands of people in there, like watching these hands play out? Everybody's going nuts. And you're not even really risking that much, so like there'd be plenty of people who would do it, like, just, you know, take a chance. Why not? It's like, if you win money. So it's not even like you have to play a poker tournament to win money. You just have to put $150 in, like people do at casinos all the time.
This would be a great
World Series tournament, that's for sure.
I you think about how it would run. I mean, the one thing I think about is the logistics. If you want to have the circus atmosphere, you kind of have to have everybody doing the flip at the same time. But here's the thing. This would have to be, I think. It wouldn't have to be, but I think it would be a re-entry tournament. So essentially, anyone who doesn't win their flip would want to have the opportunity to go and get another one. So the question is, do you just run constant satellites, and as soon as you've got 10, you send them to a table, or do you just have flights where, like, every 10 minutes you do a flip and you get as many as you register as many as you can in that time, and you know, maybe you allow people to register for 10 in advance. You register for 10, and if you win your first one, then you can go get your money back on the other ones. I don't know how you do it, but I guarantee you, like, for example, Daniel Negreanu, I have a feeling, would do this in an instant. He would buy in 40 times if need be. He'd buy in 50, 100, as many times as he possibly could to make sure that he got into the money and then was able to play in the event. There would be a lot of guys that would be doing that.
Yeah, but you want to know what this is a tournament whose primary target audience should be Daniel Negreanu. There should be a tournament restrict the number of flights. Say, we are going to do 20 flights on this. And that's the number of flights that we're going to do, and that's it. It's not a never-ending thing. It's going to be 20 flights. With 20 flights, we expect a field of this size. And go ahead and restrict, because you want to know what? If you do the 20 flights and you've got some great players sitting on the sideline, that's really good, because it gives other players a chance to go ahead and win a tournament. And it gives other people a guy. If it's a $150 flip, I might do it. I might get in there twice just to see. And if I get in there twice and it's a grand spectacle and I win a flip, it'd be fantastic. Yeah, and I'm sitting there watching it, and the idea that I made it into a tournament and not Daniel Negreanu would just crack me up. It'd be awesome.
I don't really have an issue with allowing people multiple buy-ins, just because it means that not only do they have to buy in multiple times, but it means that every time they buy in, 9 other people buy in. So giving them another shot increases the prize pool by, you know, an extra 10 buy-ins. It's not just like, okay, well, they're flipping coins at a 10% rate every time. It's like they can only get into another flight if there's going to be 9 other players who also want to get into that flight.
Oh yeah, and I actually think restricting the flights is actually creates demand. It's actually a good thing.
Well, you're always restricting the flights, because the tournament has to start at some point. So
yeah.
You know, once the tournament starts, then the flights are over. So there's always going to be that, you know, restriction.
But I think you have to restrict it
to a certain number of flights.
I think you do. I mean, because that's sort of the fun of it. You know that you've got a limited chance of getting into the tournament and to the World Series of Poker. And let me tell you what, the World Series of Poker needs a little bit of degeneracy right now.
This actually presents a really great opportunity. This actually presents a really great opportunity for WorldSeriesOfPoker.com to run, like, super satellites into these kind of tournaments where, okay, you know, you get into a $15 buy-in, and then everybody who wins that goes into a $150. It's like the next step. And then, let's say you eventually get in the tournament. Well, by the time you get to Vegas, you're already in the money. And you've never had to leave your house. You've only have invested $15 or even $1.50 or 15 cents, you know, whatever you want. I think this is a great opportunity.
Yeah,
I'm in. Let's do it.
I love it. I mean, I think this makes a lot of sense. It's just but I like the spectacle of the flight. I like the idea, Aaron, and you mentioned this earlier. I don't know whether you talked about Dan about Jack Effel on the mic forcing the dealers to do it hand by hand. And just the sheer chaos of the situation. I mean, this, if you open the World Series with this type of chaos, it'd be fantastic. And it and you can do it for so little money that it really brings in truly casual players.
What do you think the entry would be? Say it's for a $1,500 tournament. How much does the WSOP have to make on each one? Can they? Can they? Would they do this for what? $165 each, probably.
No, because
and
I don't think
get,
yeah, once you can still profit from the $1,500 buy-in. You can make once it gets to $1,500, take $100 out of that or $150 out of that. You don't have to charge on the.
You don't think
the
that they? You don't think that they will? Of course they will.
Well, maybe they will, but I don't think they need to.
Well, essentially, what happens is when they do, they take 9% out of a $1,500 buy-in. So I guess they could do, but the thing of it is, they have to pay the dealers. They've got, you know, even though it's one hand, they're going to take something out of it. I mean, I bet they would charge $165, and then they take $9. They take $15. They'd get $150 for each flip, and then they take 9% out of the $1,500.
Why don't you just charge $151? Because you're already taking 9% out of the tournament. The flip takes 5%.
I'm not arguing with you. I'm not arguing. You're right. But I'm just telling you, you got to be real about what would happen.
I know, but I think that they wouldn't need to charge that much. Like, I don't think they would.
Of course they don't need to.
But
they will.
But they will.
They will.
I mean, let's just say they do it for 160.
I'd still do it. I'd do it once. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to quibble over the $10. There will be people who will, and those are going to be the people who do it 10, 12, who are prepared to do it 10 or 12 times.
But here's the thing: this
yeah,
tournament
no, I'd do
isn't
it once
for them.
Sure.
I think that's the thing to remember, and we sometimes forget it when we talk about, you know, what this pro poker player is saying about this tournament, what they're saying about this tournament, what they're saying about this tournament. Not all tournaments are for them. And it would be nice to have a tournament for the rest of us.
Festivus for the rest of us.
A Festivus for the rest of us. Yes, indeed. Yes,
actually,
indeed.
Actually, an interesting opportunity. What you could do is charge $165, and then once you get to the real tournament, it becomes a bounty tournament. Every person you knock out, you get an extra $150. No, nobody likes that.
I'm just thinking about our own satellite that I spend way too much time thinking about coordinating and running and wondering why we just don't have a flip-out tournament to determine who from my home game goes plays at the World Series.
Yeah, could you imagine?
Jazz
the
won the first one. He's probably more likely to win. Jazz is more likely to win a flip-out tournament than he is the, you know, satellite, and he won the first year, so what's it matter anyway?
I suppose. Now that Jazz has won, you just want to throw all the rules out. I see what's going on here. Oh, poor Jazzy. I find this fascinating. I think it's interesting. I like the concept of this flip tournament, and I do. I think it's a tournament for the rest of us, and I think it's something the WSOP can get behind. A low buy-in way to get into and a really fun low buy-in way to get into a WSOP tournament and play for a bracelet and win some money to say, hey, I cashed in a WSOP tournament. And
absolutely,
I think that's just a blast. I think that's really cool. And or even to say I played in a WSOP tournament, and not just a satellite, but the actual WSOP tournament. And yeah, it might have been only for one hand, and it was on a coin flip, but at least it gives you a chance to walk away with a bad beat story. I had queens, the other guy had tens. Damn, 10 hit on the river. I can't believe it. I was this far from being in the money.
No, it's always going to be the guy with 8-3 that wins. That's part of the fun of this, though, I think. I mean, that's what I think. You mentioned it a little bit early, but that's part of the fun of this is, like, everybody gets dealt cards. Everybody turns them up, and you let everyone sit there for, like, you know, 30 seconds to look over all the hole cards chatter about who's the favorite, and have all the banter of, you know, like, you know, basically who's going to win, and all, you know, the guy with aces feels great. But really, he's only got, like, you know, a 25% chance to win against 9 opponents. And then the flop comes out and make him sit there and stare at that for a while just to, you know, just to twist the knife in the wound of the guy who had aces that now look like they're going to get cracked, or the guy that's got the flush draws sitting there waiting to see if it's going to hit. You know, and then the people who are already drawing dead are pissed and walk away. You know, I mean, and then if you were able to do it simultaneously and you've got 60, 70 tables of people doing this, it would just be outstanding.
Yeah, it would be a lot of fun. And the one cool thing about the reentry concept that I do like, and I'm generally opposed to reentry, is watching a Daniel Negreanu or someone of his ilk like reenter 15 times and lose all 15 times. You got to admit, it would be amusing, wouldn't it?
It would be. I mean, because it would be such an immaterial loss for him, it would be fun. Because he would absolutely enjoy it in the spirit that it should be enjoyed. It would be sad to see someone who couldn't afford to have something like that continue to try to, you know, jam it in there and keep buying back in. But to watch someone like Negreanu, who it's immaterial, he would have so much fun with it. It would be a great spectacle to watch.
And now here's the ultimate question. We'll close on this. Will Chainsaw enter the tournament?
No, because his expertise is min cashing. His expertise is making it to the money. So removing that period of the tournament where he is able to, quote unquote, fold his way to a min cash, that presents no advantage to him.
Dan, what do you think?
Who is this?
Alan Kessler, the Chainsaw.
Oh, okay. Well, if that is your strategy, then no. Then you definitely don't want to get into a tournament like this.
I wonder how Alan feels about his strategy being characterized by Aaron Todd.
I am just quoting Rose from the micros.
Oh,
watch
okay.
As you fold your way to a min cash.
All right, fair enough. I think that's a good place to end this discussion, with Rose taking a gratuitous shot at Alan Kessler via Aaron Todd. All right. Last week we did not do best bets because we were in complete bracketology mode. We picked every game in the tournament. Aaron recorded these picks and is here to gloat. Aaron, the stage is yours.
First round, Dan was had 21 out of 32 games correct. Vin, you had 24 out of 32 games correct. I had 27 out of 32. I got the first 12 right, which if you were familiar with the $1 billion bracket challenge, you had to get every game on your bracket right. And if you were paying any attention to the games on Thursday, there were some real crazy outcomes where it looked like one team was going to win and then the other team came back, and then it looked like one team was going to win, the other team came back to take the lead, and then the team you thought was going to win came back and still ended up coming back to win. So I had the first 12 results right. So I actually went to bed on Thursday night with a shot. You know, it was 12 for 12, and I wasn't going to stay up to watch the rest of the games because I knew that I wasn't actually going to win the $1 billion. But it made it much more exciting to go on that greater run to start things. Definitely a great challenge, and I hope that every year I get some sort of sweat through Thursday, at least get through the first 6-8 games, because it makes it a lot of fun. Second round, Dan and Vin, you guys both had 9 correct out of the 16 to the Sweet 16 teams. I had 10 out of 16. So if we're doing traditional scoring, Dan, you have 39 points. Vin, you have 42 points, and I have 47. I have all 4 of my final 4 teams. You guys both lost Wichita State. So there are some scenarios in which you can come back to take the lead from me here. If UConn makes it to the Final Four, that'll give Dan a big boost. If Wisconsin makes it to the Final Four, that'll give Vin a big boost. So outside of those two scenarios, it looks like I've already wrapped up the bracket. But those two things certainly could happen.
All righty then. We got games this weekend, Thursday night, probably, starting today. We're not picking those games, are we? Are we going back to our normal best bets?
I've got normal best bets, but they happen to be NCAA games, but I do have best bets. I didn't pick
all three
games.
Yeah, are you prepared with your best bets?
I am prepared.
All right, and I'm going hockey with mine, but Dan, let's start with you.
All right, I am going with Stanford against the money line to beat Dayton, taking them at minus 165.
No love for the Flyers.
No. I mean, they've had a good run, but Stanford's size is so good. I'm going to go with Baylor to cover the 3.5 points, or not to cover. They are getting 3.5 points. So they are going to cover their spread, but they are not the favorite. They are the dog. And that's a minus 110. And they are playing Wisconsin. And I am going, even though this will kill my bracket, I like the odds to take San Diego State at plus 280 against the money line, against Arizona.
That's a really good bet. San Diego State is a very good basketball team. And you can get about plus 280, you're doing really well.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising to be plus 280 against anyone.
Yeah. Aaron, what do you
got? The spread is 7.5 points, Vin.
But it's a money line bet.
I'm looking at it, and it's eight.
At eight? No, my lines could be
but
old.
Dan's,
I'm refreshing.
Yeah, but Dan's taking a money line bet, right?
Yes, he is, but I'm just telling you how big the spread is. That's a big spread in basketball.
Yeah, the odds makers have that wrong.
When I wrote my top 10 earlier this week, I actually have the top 10 Sweet 16 bets. Arizona was a 6.5 point favorite, and I took Arizona then. And you're right, Dan, it is up to 8 points now. So I know Vin thinks that that's probably not a good pick, but I'm going to stick by the 6.5. I wouldn't take it at 8, though. That's for darn sure. That's a lot of points in a basketball game.
And it doesn't reflect how good San Diego State is.
Yeah, I for some reason I'm not a believer. I picked against them in every. I picked them to lose in the first round. I don't know anything about the team other than the guy who coaches it used to coach Michigan, I think. But that's all.
Yes, Steve Fisher. Yeah. He's got some talent. Look, Steve Fisher is. I mean, proves my working theory about college basketball in particular is that West Coast teams like San Diego State should have no problem fielding really good basketball teams because they have recruiting advantages that the rest of the country doesn't have, which is warm weather and really good-looking women. And with that combination, you should be able to attract top-flight players to your school.
How does Michigan State get any guys?
Tom Izzo.
Tom Izzo.
Okay. Is he really good looking?
but that's my point, though, is that West Coast schools like Long Beach State and like San Diego State, they really should be able to attract top-flight talent to their school if you give them the right
recruiting
pitch.
It might be hard to get them to focus on basketball.
Did you guys see, I think it was some University of Maryland students put in a Freedom of Information request to a bunch of different universities regarding their policies towards teams, player policies, what the rules for players were. And so the University of Georgia was forced to reveal what documents they handed to players, saying these are our policies that the players have to follow. And they had a detailed sexual conduct policy, the University of Georgia did, including the things like no really does mean no, which you would think doesn't have to be said, but apparently it does. Apparently at the University of Georgia, orgies are not allowed. Nor are gangbangs. This is specified. This is really remarkable. And then there's also a suggestion in there is don't wear yourself out in bed before a game.
Man.
Women,
your team policies.
Women, what is it? Well, what's Mick's statement from Rocky? Women weaken legs. That's what he says.
Oh, I'm going to make sure it was the University of Georgia that I'm correctly impugning now. And so while I do this, Dan, why don't you go ahead with your best bet?
Dan already did that.
Aaron, why don't you go ahead with your best bet?
I had a lot of bets in my Sweet 16 bets column earlier this week, and I took the ones that I liked best. One of them is Florida-UCLA. The over-under on Monday was set at 137. It's now gone up to 138. I like the under here. Florida is a great defensive team. They usually allow less than 60 points a game. UCLA does have a powerful offense, but I think Florida's defense is going to outduel UCLA's offense. I don't think anyone gets to 70 points in this game, and if no one gets to 70, it's pretty unlikely that the under is going to hit. So I'm going to take the under on the UCLA Florida game. The other Thursday game is I'm going to go slightly against Dan's pick. I like Dayton plus 3 here. Dayton, Syracuse. One of the things about Syracuse is they have players that have a great deal of length. Stanford has some great height on the interior, but Dayton already showed that they can beat a superior Syracuse team. Like, I don't think anyone's going to argue that Syracuse isn't better than Stanford. Dayton beat them, and they were able to beat their length in the interior. So I think Dayton gives Stanford a heck of a game here. I love getting 3 points. So hopefully, Dan, Stanford wins by 2, and we can both win this bet. And then finally, on a Friday night game, Kentucky-Louisville, I am shocked to be honest that Louisville is as big a favorite as they are. They're a 4.5 point favorite. This is a real rivalry game. I know Louisville's probably got a better team, and you know this is likely to be a Louisville win in the end. It's right now the line's at 4.5. It was 5 on Monday. But I still love Kentucky getting 4.5 points in this game. I feel like this is a last possession game. This is going to be a close battle. I really don't see Louisville running away in this game. So I love getting 4.5 here for Kentucky. So I'm going to take Kentucky in the points.
All right. All right.
And if you want to check out the rest of my bets, you can read my column at CasinoCityTimes.com.
Please do. Please do go to CasinoCityTimes.com and read Aaron's column. It's a very good column. I am going to read from Deadspin, which reported this. It is the Student Press Law Center that published the findings. They were looking for public records requests for what college athletic programs expects from their players. These are published guidelines, these are guidelines that are handed to players. This is from the guideline that the University of Georgia gave to their men's basketball team. No means no. Date rape is a serious issue. You don't own your girlfriend. Stay out of gray areas. Orgies and gangbangs are inappropriate. Never assault or intimidate a woman. Birth control is your responsibility too. Don't spend all your energy in bed all night. Here's my favorite one. Hickeys/passion marks should not ever be noticed by coaches. Passion marks?
I mean...
And then one...
Some people need these helpful hints.
One, not two or three girlfriends. One.
Man, way to trample First Amendment rights.
I mean, look, these are good suggestions. I mean, these are good rules to live by, aren't they?
I mean, I already get nagged by one wife, so I couldn't imagine more than one. So, yeah, good, helpful hint.
I can't believe these are in the guidelines. I mean, well, some of them you shouldn't. Look, let me back up and say, look, Jay Perry is a serious issue. We're not making fun of it. And good for the University of Georgia saying, reinforcing that with their players, because players do come with a general series of entitlements that come with them. But, I mean, the fact that you have to lay out in your guidelines to athletes that you don't own your girlfriend, I mean, hickeys and passion marks should never be known. It's like, what's a passion mark?
That's just what the kids are calling these days.
Oh. All right, that is from the University of Georgia. I share it because I can. And that comes from the student Press Law Center via Deadspin. All right. Do we have any comment on that, or do you just want me to move on?
I think I'm going to talk to my lawyer before I comment on that.
All right. We are moving on. Aaron's just silent on the whole thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I used to work in college athletic departments, and they had things like this all the time. Things that you'd think are common sense, but they wanted to cover their bases. I don't blame them.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to end that discussion. All right, I am not picking NCAA tournament games this week, not because I don't want to, but Michigan State has reached its Sweet 16, and me picking NCAA tournament teams at this point, A, I've already picked the brackets, but B, any other picking of tournament teams constitutes bad juju in my mind, and I do not want to introduce bad juju. And so I'm going
bad
hockey.
Bad in the year of Sparty.
Huh? No. I want no bad juju anywhere near Sparty. Sparty's got a chance to reach the Final Four, so I'm not going anywhere near the NCAA tournament. So with that in mind, I'm looking at hockey, and the Blackhawks are playing the Bruins. Stay away from this game. It cannot be bet. Just stay away from it. You can't do it. And the same thing with the Kings Penguins. Just watch those two games and enjoy them, because those are two great hockey games tonight. I won't be betting on the Red Wings or picking the Red Wings because, once again, the Red Wings are fighting for a playoff spot. More bad juju. And so that brings me down to the Islanders versus the Tampa Bay Lightning. The over-under here is set at 5.5. I am going to take the over, which pays off at 10-13. These two teams are going to put some goals up. And so I'll take the over at 5.5. I'm going to move on to the Minnesota Wild versus the St. Louis Blues. The over-under here is set at 5. I am going to take the under. I'm expecting a defensive battle here. I'll take 21-20. The under pays, and that line is set at 5. And finally, I'm going to take the Vancouver Canucks versus the Colorado Avalanche. Vancouver's just a hot, sticky mess. They're just terrible. And the over-under here is set at 5.5. The over's paying off at 11-10. Look, the under is more likely to hit. I just don't like the 10-13, so I'm going to take the over at 5.5. And those are my three hockey bets for the day. And that's it for the Casino City Gang this week. We thank you for joining us. Any final thoughts before we get out of here, gentlemen?
I don't think my bracket could get much worse, but we will see after this weekend. It could completely implode.
Aaron, what about you?
Yeah, I'm just looking. I want to see all my teams win in my bracket to see how close I was to getting into the top 20. I'm sure that I can't do it because I only have 6 out of 8 possible Elite Eight teams. But even if I get all 6 and I get the Final Four and I get all the Final Four games right, it'll be interesting to see where I finish. And if I am close enough that, you know, a key game like the New Mexico State-San Diego State game ends up, you know, ruining my chances, then that's it's going to hurt, but I would still love to see it happen. You know, you always want to be close.
Well, Michigan State plays a very tough University of Virginia squad Friday night. It's going to be a very close game. It's going to be a very difficult game. Should they advance there, they've got a reasonable chance at the Final Four. I will be rooting hard for Michigan State, not only as they do all weekend long, but particularly this weekend, because they've got a shot of making sure, and they have to go to the Final Four to make sure to ensure this happens. But if they go to the Final Four, every four-year player under Tom Izzo will have reached the Final Four, which is just a remarkable achievement. I don't think any other coach has the privilege of saying that, and so I hope it happens. That's it for the Casino City Game. We thank you for joining us on your podcast for all things gambling, and we'll talk to you next week. Follow all local, state, and federal laws in your jurisdiction regarding gambling.